Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Our guest this week is a best-selling author and award-winning anthropologist. Meredith F. Small has written a new book, Here Begins the Dark Sea, Venice, a Medieval Monk, and the Creation of the Most Accurate Map of the World. It's the story of the famous Fra Mauro map, created by a team led by Venetian monk Fra Mauro from 1450 to 1459, and it's an astonishing work of cartography that was the first to break with many classical and medieval traditions in map-making and could be considered the first truly scientific map of the Earth. There's even a connection to the Apollo moon program. The original landing site for the Apollo 13 mission, which of course failed to land on the moon, was the Fra Mauro region, and it's where Apollo 14 successfully landed, and Alan Shepard famously hit golf balls out of the lunar regolith at Fra Mauro. As we'll hear, Meredith Small discovered this map almost by accident, but became entranced by it, and we think you will too as we explore the Mapamundi of Fra Mauro together on this show. Meredith Small, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's really nice to be here.
Yeah, this map of the world, Mapamundi, I had vaguely knew about this map. So I'd like to know first from you, like, when did you first encounter Fra Mauro's map?
Well, I was going to Venice a lot for about the last, 10, 15 years. I started to learn Italian just for fun and just being, a typical American of my age that never really learned another language. And I just randomly chose Italian. And my family and I had lived in Venice twice, a month each. And so when my daughter went on school trips, I started going to Venice and going to language school there. And during that time, I would go into all the museums. I've been into all them. And so it must have been a good, 8-10 years ago, I was in the Museo Correr, which is the Central Civic Museum of Venice. It's in the Piazza San Marco, across from the Basilica, for listeners who know Venice. And I was actually trying to find a staircase down into the Marciana Library. And so I had walked to the end of the museum through the Sansovino Reading Room, and then was heading for what I thought was a staircase, which it wasn't. But there was an alcove there, and there was this map. And at that time, of course, I knew nothing about cartography at all. And I looked to the right, and I was amazed, because it's 7 feet in diameter. It's gigantic, and it's so beautiful. The blues, the pinks, the whites. And I stood there thinking, what in the world is this? And I noticed that across the surface of it, there was all kinds of writing, but of course it was too far away to read. The map just sort of haunted me. And every time I would go to Venice, I'd go and I'd just look at it. And then one time I went and it wasn't there anymore, and they were restoring it. And then came, the first book I wrote about Venice is called Inventing the World, and it's about Venetian inventions. And in there, I wrote a little bit about this map. But then came COVID, and I had always wanted to write a book about one thing. And so I said to my agent, I want to write about this map, and got the contract. And from there, I began to learn about world maps and really how important this particular map was. And now it feels like my best friend.
It's really fascinating to kind of follow along with your journey through the book of your journey of discovery and learning about this map. It really is the ultimate rabbit hole. The more you learn about this map, the more interesting it becomes and the more you want to know.
True.
So let's start with some basics, though. When was the map created, and over what time period? Because it took a long time to make this map.
It did. It took 9 years, and it was completed, they think, in 1459. On the back of the map, it's written 1460, but the idea is that that's when it was actually hung up in the monastery where it was made. And in fact, the creator, Fra Mauro, who was what you'd call a lay priest, he wasn't a full monk, he died in 1459. So they think that it was hung after he was dead. And so it's not signed with his name, but there is documentation that shows that he did it. So for 9 years, he worked with a team of cartographers, artists, calligraphers, everything. And we have all his notes are lost, so we really don't know the whole progress. And then they made two copies of it, the same team, after he was dead. They made those copies, but the map hung in the monastery for 100 years, and some people came to visit it, but it didn't really get famous until much later.
And so the map that's hanging in the library that you saw, that's the original map?
It is. People often think it's a copy that was made for King Alfonso V of Portugal, but in fact, further research has shown that this is the original one, and it was made for the government of Venice.
Let's have you describe the map for us. First of all, what's it made out of?
It's drawn on vellum, which is, you know, leather, basically.
Like parchment.
And that parchment, and it's glued to what we would call, not fiberboard, but plywood, basically plywood. So there's a disc that's 7 feet in diameter, and that fits into a round circular gold frame. And then that fits into a much larger square frame. And one of the things that's interesting about the construction is that the map itself, the geography, is in the central circle. And then his ideas about the cosmos and the planet and paradise, those are in the four corners of the square frame with explanations. And the coloration is remarkable. The land is sort of an off-white color. The sea is a beautiful blue, probably made with indigo or something like that. And the waves are drawn on it. It's almost as if someone invented a tool like a fork and then dipped it in white paint or ink and made the waves. It's also covered with all different kinds of boats from all different cultures. And I should also mention that the map is upside down. It's facing south, where we would have the north.
Well, that depends on your point of view, doesn't it?
True.
There really is no such thing as up and down when it comes to really to geography. You know, our Western-centric point of view that, you know, the north is up and, you know, Western civilization revolves around Europe.
True.
But my question is, why did he deliberately made that choice?
He did.
Why? Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, no one really knows, but the speculation is that a lot of the older Islamic maps were always pointed towards the south, and that he may have been copying those. But no one knows. It was unusual for the time for him to do that. But I also speculate, and again, this is a complete hypothesis on my part, is that when the map was drawn, of course, it was flat. It wasn't hanging on a wall. It was probably flat. And so you could walk all the way around it. But we know it's really oriented towards the south because all the writing is, you know, tipped the other way. So the geography is to the south. The writing is the opposite way.
It's funny because, you know, on first glance, you look at it, it looks a little strange. And then, but then if you look at it upside down, then you go,
soon as you look, what I always do with world maps is if I can't find my way, I just look for the boot of Italy. And once you find the boot of Italy, realize that the big continent to the south is Africa. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look exactly how we think of Africa today, but there are certainly points of reference. And one of the weird things is there is the tip of Africa has a river north of it. And that's a confusion. And speculation is that perhaps this piece of land at the tip of Africa is actually Madagascar. But in fact, Madagascar is a little bit higher than that. And so it might just be a mistake. He may have thought there was a river there. Maybe some Arab sailors had gone into a river there and then gone back out because he was working mostly from what people told him. I mean, he certainly had access to other world maps, but of course, there was no printing press. So it's not as if he had the history of world maps sitting in front of him the way I did when I wrote this book.
Yeah, well, you briefly mentioned it, but I'd like to go into more detail. Let's talk about the corners of the map, because that quite striking. So start with any corner you wish and then proceed. Tell us about what are on those corners, because that was really interesting to me.
The southwestern corner, let's call it the bottom left, is paradise. So this is the Garden of Eden, and it's walled in this, and there's Adam and Eve are in there. And then there's an angel standing at the gates of paradise and going to a rocky outcrop right next to it. And this is supposedly the source of the four rivers of the world.
So that's interesting in itself, because prior to Fra Mauro's map, Most of these maps made in medieval Europe were based on the Bible. And so you would definitely have things like, you know, the Garden of Eden prominent. But this map is kind of a deviation, a head towards secular map making. So you kind of, it's interesting to me that you find the Garden of Eden is down in the corner, you know, this kind of, it's not of the world in a way. So I thought that was interesting.
It's very interesting, especially coming from a Catholic monk, that he chose to disconnect the religion off of this map. And that, as you say, that's one of the significant breaking points that this map pushed, is more towards science, the science of geography, let's say, and away from religion. And so it's very pointed that he put paradise is, you know, Garden of Eden is here, but it's outside the map where everybody else would have it somewhere. And also Jerusalem, et cetera, or Mount Ararat for Noah's Ark. They're here, but they aren't emphasized the way they are in other medieval maps.
Fascinating. Okay, let's go to the upper left-hand corner then.
The upper left is his cosmos. If you can get close to it, get a close-up picture. So there's an outward ring of blue, and then they're sort of whitish, and then it almost looks like you're looking at a bullseye. And this, if you can get close to it, it actually has words like Chilio, Emporium, and they're in Latin, and they're names of the sky and the sea and then the planets. And so he is describing the universe there.
I saw the name of the moon, Luna, and the planets, yeah. Mars, and et cetera.
Saturn.
So it's definitely the Ptolemaic, you know, system, which is, you know,
absolutely,
at that time in 1460, you know, that was the cosmic view that they had, was the Ptolemaic system with the Earth at the center. So that's his, like, kind of placing the Earth in the cosmos, as it were.
It is. And what's also interesting is that he actually, on the map itself, he argues with Ptolemy over and over. And one of the things he did that was different is he did not follow Ptolemy's prescriptions, but he does on the outside of the map. Again, a disconnect between what you see in the geography in the center of the map and the outside, which is more philosophical in a way and more religious.
Fascinating. Okay, let's go to the upper right-hand corner.
Those are the elements, sea, air, water, that sort of stuff. And my personal favorite actually is the bottom right, because he's showing the globe and he shows that it's half of it is full of water. But of course, he doesn't know what the other side of the earth looks like. So it's just a circle. It's not a globe. And it's all about climate and heat and cold and suggestions about where people can and cannot live. So again, all of these are his ideas about the cosmos, but also his religious ideas about the cosmos at the same time.
What do we actually know about Fra Mauro? Do we know very much about him, or is he kind of a mystery?
He's kind of a mystery. The only bits of record are financial stuff from the monastery saying this was paid, and his name is in there. There's one sentence that Fra Mauro lives at San Michele, which is the monastery just north of Venice, right off of Venice. It's now considered the cemetery island of Venice, but back then it was a monastery. And very few references. One of him doing some survey work for the chapter that he belonged to, the Camaldese monks, over in Istria. And also he was hired by the Magistrato de Mare. They were as they always did, they changed the course of the rivers coming, the seven different rivers coming into the lagoon. And he was hired at one point to help figure out the hydraulics of one of the rivers. And that's about all we know about him. So when I get to the chapter where I want to bring the atmosphere of the times, I'm speculating based on other historians talking about the 1450s in Venice and what it was probably like for him. For example, that he may have rowed himself from San Michele to Venice. There were no bridges at that time. Everybody was rowing around on boats. And that because he was a secular monk, he wasn't cloistered. He was certainly, he had a job collecting rents in Venice for the monastery. So he was certainly walking through town. and he was talking to people and he was meeting with people. He also had access to all the books in all the libraries everywhere. And they speculate that he may have been sent books. Certainly sailors from other countries came to visit him. There's one record of delegates from Ethiopian Council came to visit him. None of these things have been really confirmed, but they're just little bits and pieces. There is only one drawing of him, and it's on a medal that was made by the state after he died, and it's just a profile. So we sort of don't even know what he looks like, in a sense.
So he really is shrouded in mystery in so many ways.
He is. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the incredible world map of 15th century Venetian monk Fra Mauro with Meredith F. Small, author of the new book, Here Begins the Dark Sea, Venice, a Medieval Monk and the Creation of the Most Accurate Map of the World. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with author Meredith Small as we talk about her new book, Here Begins the Dark Sea, about one of the first truly scientific maps of the world, the Fra Mauro map created in 15th century Venice. Tell us about Venice in 1460, because, you know, we think of it now as, you know, a place where people like to go as tourists and see the incredible artwork and the beautiful city. But back then, it really was a seat of power, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. The power of Venice really started in the 12th century when Venice started collecting salt from salt pans. And from there, who knows why, they got the brilliant idea that they could force ships coming in to bring salt, and then they could export it up into Europe. And they became middlemen doing that. And so Venice is really based on the trade in salt. And because of its geographic position, it was the bridge between the East and the West. Byzantium used to care about Venice, and then it didn't. The Romans used to care, then it didn't. They were really left on their own. And what makes it, for me, such an unusual place is that it's not one of the city-states like Florence, Milan, Ferrara. It was always a collection of people. So when they decided to form a lagoonal kind of government, they actually had representatives from all the various islands. There are 30 islands in the lagoon, and they gathered committees from all over. And even during the 1400s, the government was unusual because it wasn't based on a family. It was based on rich merchants. And at first, up until the late 1200s, everybody in town, all the men, I should say, in town could vote on everything. But then there was a change, and the aristocrats, the rich people, basically decided they wanted to have a golden book. And if you had moved to Venice, you know, in 800, you could be part of this. And so they constructed an aristocracy, and the middle citizens were kind of pushed off. But still, this place was a government that still cared about its people, the first place to have streetlights, the first place to have a ministry of health. Venetians invented quarantine. You know, there was an eye on everybody, and there were these guilds or confraternities that were there as charity operations. So they would pay for young women who didn't have a dowry. They would give them the money. One of these confraternities was in charge of carrying away the dead during the plague. And so in my view, it was certainly not perfect, but a place where you had all different classes of people mixing together, partially because of its geography. If you're a merchant and you have a palazzo, your warehouse is in the palazzo, and you're interacting with everyone who works for you every day. And then you're going around on a boat, and it's such a tiny place. It's only 2.5 miles wide, that everybody was interacting with everybody else. So it's very unusual for a European country, and yet its wealth was incredible. Venetians invented capitalism. People who got a degree in economics know this. And it was always about money, and it still is. And so they were, you know, the merchants and the traders, and everybody in town was involved with this. If they were the owners of ships, or if they were the people unloading things, or they were the traders taking them up the rivers into Europe.
The Merchants of Venice. Somebody should write a story with a title, something like that. Okay, let's talk about one of those islands in particular, the Island of the Dead. Tell us about the place where Fra Mauro lived and where this map was actually created.
If somebody goes to Venice, you go to the north part of Venice, it's called Fondamenta Nuova. Let's say you're going to go to Murano. You would get on a Vaporetto, a public water bus that would take you there in about 4 minutes. Between Murano and that north of what we consider the central part of Venice is this other island called San Michele. And so if you stand on Fondamenta Nuova, you see it, and it's beautiful. And what you see is a brick wall, a high brick wall, a beautiful gate, and then these cypresses, you know, poking up from this. And it used to be two islands, San Cristoforo and San Michele. But when Napoleon invaded Venice, took over Venice, he decided that the two islands should be joined together. So they did that. They filled in the water between the two of them, and it became one big island. And also Napoleon wanted, people were buried in Venice. If you look at the local churches, which of course are everywhere, everybody used to be buried right there under the town square in front of that church. Napoleon didn't like that. And so they dug all those bones up and said, they said, now they have to go to San Michele. And at this point, he was also deconsecrating churches and the monasteries. So San Michele still got to keep its monastery, but it got smaller and smaller and smaller. And today, if you're Venetian or an outsider, you can be buried there. But after 12 years, you're dug up, unless you're very, very wealthy. You're dug up, your bones are cleaned off, and they're taken out to one of the ossuary islands, islands full of bones, which you just can't get to. I mean, you could have someone row you there, but they have high walls. And, you know, if you go over, I understand, I haven't been there, it's piles of bones disintegrating. And that's how they dealt with living in basically a lagoon with some islands that don't support many crops, and you can't dig down that far. You hit water. So today, it is the cemetery island, and in November 2019, they recreated a bridge on pontoons from Fondamenta Nuova to San Michele, opened those gates, and we could walk across the lagoon to the island. It was pretty amazing. I recommend going there. You get off the boat with many other people who are carrying flowers, and Stravinsky is buried there, other people. And it's very silent and beautiful. And the church has been rebuilt, but it's gorgeous. And the original cloister where Fra Mauro worked is still there. And in the insert in my book, I have pictures of it. So you get absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk some more about the map itself. One of the things you mentioned that I really enjoyed were the ships. There are, it's like all the different kinds of ships that were known in the world are portrayed in the out in the ocean, aren't they?
Yes, and if anybody gets a chance to actually go see the map, you'll find yourself, you'll be able to get up really close, because when they renovated it, they put it into a big cabinet, let's call it, with a black frame around it. And so nobody's going to yell at you if you get a little close, and a light comes on and then goes off, and there's a bench in front of it. And if you look really closely, you begin to notice these different boats, such as Arab boats with these beautiful sweeping prows, and then Chinese junks, and then some ships that haven't been identified. And then you can tell the trade ships with their numbers of sails and their high sides. And there's also pieces of wood or ladders just floating in the water, which I think is really kind of cute in a way. Little pieces of flotsam and jetsam floating around.
When you look at the map, one of the things that struck me is like, there's a lot of writing on there. What is Fra Mauro and his team trying to teach us through the written word on the map?
What makes these inscriptions, and there are over 3,000 of them, what makes them so interesting, I think, are two things. One is that he's making a conversation with you, whoever is looking at this. So he does something geographically, and then he tells you why he did it. And then in some of them, they're just place names, and most of the East, meaning China, Southeast Asia, he took from Marco Polo, and word for word from Marco Polo, and also another explorer adventurer named Niccolo de Conte, who was Venetian. And he uses their words, never gives them credit, probably because it just seemed normal to him to be able to do that. And his explanations are also about people, about temples, about natural goods that you could get, gems, silver, gold, about animals, birds, tigers, lions, donkeys, everything. It is totally a conversation. And somebody wrote that these world maps were aggregators of knowledge, which I think is great. And it's also, they've been called encyclopedias, because obviously these world maps were not meant for directions. They're not, you're not expected to take them on your trade ship and figure out how to get from point A to point B. They really are an artistic and educational device. And for me as an anthropologist, what I loved were all the descriptions of peoples, their rituals, their ways of life, their language, their belief systems. It's amazing to me that I call him in the book one of the first anthropologists. He seems to be telling Western culture, there are other people out there, and they don't behave like you, they don't think like you, they don't act like you, they run their lives very differently from you. He also points out all these trade routes, and one hypothesis is he was trying to show that all the various trade routes that Venetians and Eastern traders were using could actually be linked into one big network. So he does that as well. But I, of course, love reading about the gems and how you can find them on these different islands and the spices and things that are important to Venetian traders. So it's full of information, absolutely full of it. And when I was writing the book, I read all 3,000 of them and put them into different categories. And the chapters in the book are divided between about the, you know, the basis of the map, geography, and also people and customs is a whole nother chapter, because that was my favorite, learning about the different people.
I could see that as an anthropologist for sure. And you also, in your book, you kind of, in a way, compare it to like Google Maps.
Yes.
Where, you know, when you zoom in, like, you know, on a neighborhood or something, it shows you, here are the shops that are there. There's the restaurants. There's where you could stay.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, you know, but a 1460 version.
It is. It absolutely is. And this group called Engineering Historical Memory did exactly that. They tagged it through Google Maps, and they had help from some Chinese students or from Singapore. And they went through Marco Polo's name places and realized that Fra Mauro got them right, which means Marco Polo got them right, that they were spelled correctly and they could interpret them. And in that sense, it's just a giant geography of the world of the 1450s. This is the way it looked to him. And he was also making those points about Ptolemy. He didn't like his projection. Fra Mauro believed you could sail around the tip of Africa, and he shows this on the map. It's the first clear map that shows that Africa is not running into the frame, that you really could sail around it east or west doing that. So while he's giving information, he's also trying to change the way people think about geography and about other people and other countries.
Do we have any idea of what the motivation was to make this map? What did somebody commission Fra Mauro to do it? Do we have any idea, like, why was this map made and for what purpose?
I wish I had an answer for that, because we don't really know, and we do just only have people's ideas about it. Keep in mind, this was right at the beginning of the age of discovery and the age of exploration. And so, and because of Venice's geographic position, people from all over the world came to Venice. And I think that that's part of the motivation. He did it because he could. I mean, if you were centered in Paris, you wouldn't get all these people coming from the East, from the Near East, the Far East, everywhere from Africa. They wouldn't be coming there, but they came to Venice. And so he was in a great position himself to get all this information. And that's why the King of Portugal wanted a copy. But at the same time, historically, maps in general, let alone maps of the world, were very fashionable at the time. And it was a way for people to show off that they were intellectuals. And so certainly in Venice, the houses of the nobility had maps on the walls to basically say, look at me, you know, I know all about this, even though maybe they never traveled to any of those places. So it was probably a confluence of all those things that there was this interest in maps. It'd been building and building and building. And then there he was in exactly the right position to do it. But we don't know exactly. The original map belongs to the Signore, which is the central government. There was some money coming in, but one of the academics who worked on the map said that it actually was very cheap to make, that even though it took a long time, he calculated it was something like the cost of one really fancy dress for a noblewoman. You know, and of course, those dresses are covered with pearls and all kinds of things, but that it's not much of a leap then to think maybe he would do this, but he must have had an interest. And the monastery must have had an interest. There's the idea that given that the inscriptions are in Veneziano, normally they would be in Latin, but they are not. And that's because his monastery order, the Camaldolese, were very interested in keeping the dialect and the language of the people around them. They really wanted to encourage all citizens to be educated and to learn. And so he may have written in Veneziano because this was a way to touch the public rather than just intellectuals.
And we know that this took about, 9 years to create?
Yeah.
But we really don't know, like, what that workflow would have looked like, do we? Like, how many hours a day they might have worked? Did they, you know, spend every day working on it or take weeks off? We don't know, do we?
We don't know. And we don't know exactly how big his team was. We know that the navigator and cartographer Andrea Bianco, who also made a world map before this, and he had traveled to the North Sea as an admiral, and he was working on this map. But we don't know. We can only speculate that it's hard to imagine that Fra Mauro himself wrote out all these inscriptions, that he must have had a calligrapher do them, you know, somebody who was good at that. And he had his other duties, collecting rents. And also, there's no electricity. So my guess is they didn't work at night. You know, they wouldn't be able to see that well. But it's just impossible to know.
And the way you describe that place, you can just tell that during the day, you know, it was probably flooded with beautiful light.
We don't know exactly which room he was working in, but you would guess he must have had a big room like the refectory or somewhere else, a meeting room. And when you walk around the courtyard, there's tons of light and it's beautiful. So you would expect during the day there was some. And this monastery also had a scriptorium. They taught young boys how to copy books because, you know, again, no printing press. So this monastery was known for their ability and their dedication to copying books, you know, more copies of other books. And those, of course, are all hand-drawn. And so maybe some of those boys were part of working on this map as well. It would be fabulous if we had his initial drawings, then we'd really know. But one of the interesting things on the map, in some places, the inscriptions are glued on. They're not on the canvas itself or on the vellum itself. They are almost like a post-it put on later. And the idea is that he had written something and then he changed his mind. And so these papers are glued down. And after 9 years, of course he changed his mind as new discoveries happened, geographic discoveries.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as new information came available to him, he had to say, oh, I have to update this.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Meredith Small. She's the author of the new book, Here Begins the Dark Sea, Venice, a Medieval Monk, and the Creation of the Most Accurate Map of the World. It's the story of the amazing Fra Mauro map created from 1450 to 1459 in Venice. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our exploration of the Fra Mauro world map from the 1450s with author Meredith Small. I love the title of the book, and could you tell us about the, you know, why you chose that? Because it's very appropriate. Here begins the Dark Sea.
It's in the inscriptions, and it's actually, I think it's inscription number 79, because Dr. Falcata numbered them, and it sits right next to Madagascar. And one assumes that because Western culture, especially Western Europe, thought of the Indian Ocean as a sea. They thought it was enclosed in land. They thought the tip of Africa swept around and attached to India. And so they thought it was the Indian Sea. And therefore, it was not well known. And when people think about trading in Venice, they think it was all done by boat, but that's not true. In fact, the boats were going to the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, the edge of the Mediterranean, and goods were coming from the Silk Roads across land. I mean, that's how the Polos did it. They came to land, and then they come to a port where Venice has shareholders and, you know, peers, and then the goods are loaded onto boats and taken to Venice. The trading that was going on in the so-called Indian Sea was Chinese, Indian, and Southeast Asian trading, Arab trading. But they too came to the Black Sea and traded goods. And when Frau Mauro made it clear that you could go around Africa, and then Diaz went around Africa, that changed everything, because it made trading cheaper, because you could do it by boat. You could take your boat around Africa, go to the Spice Islands, turn around, and come back. So it was very economically efficient once it was opened up.
Ah, yes. And of course, there's some things on the map that are there for the very first time, like Japan, for example,
yes.
And Java, I think. But what strikingly, of course, the Americas are not.
That's right. They're not there. I've read that there's the idea that Christopher Columbus must have known about this map. It would be hard for him not to. And whether he saw it or not, we don't know, but it must have influenced him. And I loved writing about the maps that came after, because once the explorers and traders, I mean, all this exploration was about trade. It was about making money. It wasn't about discovering new plants. It wasn't like that at all. It was economically based. England, Portugal, Spain, Venice, but realize that Venetian sailors did not cross the Atlantic, except for one, and that would be John Cabot, whose real name is Giovanni Caboto. And he was not born in Venice, but he grew up in Venice, and you can see his house there. And he was sailing under the British flag, because that's the only person who would give him money when he went to Newfoundland. But basically, it was the Portuguese and the Spanish at that point, after Frau Mauro, who were going west and trying to find China, and stumbled on these two other continents.
And another fascinating thing to me about the map and reading your book about it is that, you know, when you get to the edge of knowledge, things that he doesn't really know, what we could call like myths and marvels, things that are out there that, you know, are tantalizing, but they don't really know. Like, you know, there's like stories, I forget exactly where, of, you know, these huge caves that are filled with lions and things like that, or the stories of Prester John. Maybe you could tell us about who was or was not Prester John.
I love that story, because it was one I'd never heard of before, because I'm not really a medieval scholar, but Prester John was a fable, and yet was so alive to Western culture. They thought he was a man, a priest of some sort, who went first to China and somehow converted a zillion people and had a huge army. And then all of a sudden he was in what today we would call Ethiopia. And so he was this mythical creature who was supposedly a king at the same time, an emperor, and had people following him. And one analysis I read said, well, really, the reason this fable was there is that people were scared. They were scared of other religions. And so the idea was, oh, Prester John is there with all his people, basically Priest John with all his people, and they're all Christians. and we're all okay because there are Christians in China and there are Christians in Africa. And this myth went on forever. I mean, we think about today's conspiracy theories. It was the same sort of thing. And there is absolutely no real evidence that he ever existed.
Did you have any other kind of favorite tidbits of the map of things that are kind of fanciful?
Well, I always like the ones that are about the edge of the earth and monsters and don't go through these two rocks because people have told me, as Frau Mara would say, or sailors have told me that you will never come back. Of course, that doesn't make sense. How, you know, that means that the sailors who were saying that to him thought this happened to other people. And he does this very often. He says, people have told me. That's his reference. People have told me this, that, or the other thing. And as an academic myself, I found this in some ways, the map is so referenced. He tells you where he gets things, but then he has these other ones, these people have told me. But he seemed to be most impressed and relied mostly on firsthand speculations by sailors who came and told him things. But he always admits to those. People have told me, several sailors told me this.
Yeah, it's kind of like he's giving you a little bit of a, you know, a caveat emptor. You're like, people have told me this. I'm, you know, can't really confirm it, but just thought I'd let you know with the map.
That's how we read today, and we hear it today. But it's such in contrast to the fact that he never mentions Marco Polo or Niccolo da Conte or Pordenone, who was another, you know, explorer type. And that's sort of amusing, maybe just because Marco Polo was just like a guy from my town said this.
Yeah. And you've mentioned some copies of the maps because the map really did have a tremendous amount of influence over time. Can you tell us a bit about the map's influence, you know, from its time on?
Sure. Well, it certainly influenced the Portuguese. They got their copy, was delivered to them. It is now lost. And then the Portuguese began to go down the west side of Africa. So we don't know exactly how it influenced them, but Frau Mauro's Africa is a little out of shape. And the Gulf of Guinea is gigantic, but you know, bigger than it should be. But the Portuguese had not gone far enough yet. They had just gotten to the Gulf of Guinea and they stopped. And so then they went farther down. And another copy went to the Medici in Florence and speculation that it was burned during Savonarola's time. And if you go to Florence and you go into the map room in the Palazzo Vecchio, you can see these beautiful globes and everything. And the idea is, maybe the copy was in there for a while. And some of those maps that are in there now, people have said, well, they must have seen Frau Mara's map, but that one is gone as well. And then much later, a group of British noblemen hired an artist to go to Venice and make a copy. And I don't remember the date exactly, somewhere in the 1800s. And this guy made a perfect copy, including the inscriptions. And that's now in the British Museum and you can go see it. And it's supposed to be great. I haven't seen it myself, but it's supposed to be great. And then someone else, a Venetian photographer, took photographs of it. And they're giant photographs that are then pasted together. And he won a medal at a World's Fair for it was like the largest photograph of its time put together by separate pieces. And of course, you can buy a poster on Amazon if you'd like. You know,
and it's such a beautiful piece of artwork that I could see where you know anyone would you know that loves maps especially.
Yeah,
it can be viewed through so many lenses. You know, as an anthropological piece of evidence, it's a thing of its time, its history, its geography, but it's also just a beautiful piece of art.
It is. It really is a beauty. It's striking, absolutely striking. And when I know people are going to Venice, usually they go see the typical things. And I say, trust me on this. Go see this map. And the times I've been, I always go when I'm there. And they've made a new exhibit where you see some other very important maps and also a piece of Marco Polo's will. And also the Science Museum in Florence has made a fabulous interactive video kind of thing that you can play with there on a giant screen. So you can get really close in and they have explanations about it. And I was standing there a couple of years ago, right after they opened this exhibit, and it was an American couple there. And the gentleman turned out was a geographer. And he said to me, "This is the most important map in the world, isn't it?" And I just looked at him and said, "Yes."
Yeah. It's also striking, you know, I've seen the image from Apollo 17, the blue marble mm-hmm. image is one of the most famous photographs of all time of the whole Earth. And that side by side with Fra Mauro's map, it's striking how accurate he was.
That's right. I have in the insert, I was able to get, which you can because they're free from NASA, a Landsat photograph, which of course means satellites that are circling the Earth as we speak are taking photographs. And what the Landsat people did was they reoriented, they pieced together the pictures and then reoriented it in the orientation of Fra Mauro's map. And it's shocking how much he got right for how old this map is. And I love that as too. And I also have in there a picture of Apollo 14 when Alan Shepard struck golf balls in the Fra Mauro formation.
Fra Mauro Highlands. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's one of the loveliest things when I was writing this book to be able to connect up with space exploration with Fra Mauro, and that the people who make names for craters on the moon recognize early on this geography by naming the Fra Mauro formation with the Fra Mauro Highlands. And that's where the book ends, where these astronauts are walking across that formation.
When I saw this book and saw the title and saw the name Fra Mauro, that, you know, that clicked with me as like, that's the Apollo 14 landing site, you know, and that's like, who's Fra Mauro? Oh yeah, he's a cartographer or a map, something. I don't know what, but because of the name Fra Mauro and my Apollo connections, that's what got me really interested in reading your book.
I also talk about astronauts at the beginning of chapter two, when I'm going to talk about the history of world maps before his map, and that that's the first picture we have of the Earth floating in space, that iconic picture with a slice of the moon in front. And the point being that humans were drawing maps of the world when they had in fact never seen the world in a way till then.
The famous Earthrise photograph from Apollo 8. What also strikes me is the astronauts all say the same thing, is when you look at the Earth, the beautiful Earth from space, and the colors of it are so vivid, which is also kind of neat about Fra Mauro's map, the beautiful color of it. There are no boundaries. There are no lines on there telling you this is the edge of this country and it goes into that one. And that's one of the striking things about looking at the actual Earth from space.
And I think that as people, we are so used to now, let's say culturally, we learn what the Earth looks like, not realizing that what we're looking at is political boundaries, countries, and that the Earth is not delineated by countries. You know, there are no lines drawn on the Earth. And I said to an Australian friend of mine, I really would like a map of the world with Australia at the center. And he went, yeah, right, of course. Because that's how he sees the world. Australia is the center. And then the uses that maps have been put to in terms of not just travel, but other things, social issues that are projected onto maps, and how important that is to understand the geography of this planet and how it affects human groups, ecological issues, everything. I mean, humans were drawing maps before they had writing. So they've been with us for a long time.
Yeah, maps have always been something that I've loved, and you know, I've got a map in front of me right now. It's a map of it's a topographic map of the Sierra Nevada. I just love maps and love to look at them and think about what it would be like to go to that place and explore it. Maps are something that, you know, you can go on an exploration right there, just staring at that map and imagining what's there. So I think about Fra Mauro's map and the people that must have seen it, you know, when it was new, imagining themselves traveling to some of those distant places.
Right. And coming out of, you know, first the Dark Ages and then the Middle Ages. And this is for them an eye opener. You know, we're looking at it in the past, but imagine it's 1459 and you see it. what a shock to see this. And there were other world maps, but they always had angels and Jesus, and, you know, they were geographically not correct because they were basically propaganda. And so things were exaggerated to make that stand out. And that's why in the title it says the most accurate map of the world of its time, because he really was trying to get the geography correct. It wasn't perfect, but he did quite a job doing that.
Well, it's a wonderful book. And thanks for sharing your knowledge of Fra Mauro's map and for writing this incredible book, Here Begins the Dark Sea. Meredith Small, it's been wonderful to have you on the show. Thank you.
It's been great to talk about it. It was such a fun project, and I loved every minute of learning everything. It was fabulous.
Thanks again to our guest, Meredith F. Small. Her new book, Here Begins the Dark Sea, Venice, a Medieval Monk, and the Creation of the Most Accurate Map of the World, is published by Pegasus Books and available at most major booksellers, or order it from your local community bookseller. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.